question.
Thank you very much. Very happy to be here. Neighboring China is the title of a four-year research project I actually carried out between 2011 and 2015. So it's over. The subtitle, What Does China's Rise Mean for the People Living Along the Borders? That was my one-line pitch to explain the project. While much is being written about China's rapid development and standing in the world, about China's relations to neighboring states and the geopolitical shifts in Asia at the beginning of the 21st century, the actual impact of these large processes on the communities living along the borders of the PRC have not received the attention they deserve, I believe. And my concern in this project was thus to look at neighboring not as a static spatial relation, but as an active process that requires skills, and as an active process that can only be understood against the background of mobility and the long histories of mobility and the places at stake. But as title of this talk, Neighboring China is also the result of an accident of sorts, or maybe rather a byproduct of the terrain I'm going to talk about. When Magnus asked me for a title, I was in northern Burma without internet access, so he just used Neighboring China as a stand-in. When I started preparing for this talk, I realized that I actually never took stock of these last 4 years, and I never really took the time to take stock of these last 4 years and make sense of what I believe to have learned in a larger context. So this talk is my chance to do so, and in the past few days, I have actually been very productive. What I will present here is thus less of a polished talk. It's rather a rough and early version of an idea that is literally about 5 days old. So regionally, the scope of my argument is limited to the mountains, to the mountainous areas surrounding the People's Republic's contemporary borders, roughly from the Southeast Asian Massif to the Tian Shan and the Pamirs. Tian Shan is where this picture is taken. It shows Chinese trucks waiting in front of the Kyrgyz border post at Dorongard Pass between Xinjiang and Kyrgyzstan. My main area of research are actually the Himalayas, more precisely the remote corners of far western and far eastern Nepal, bordering Tibet. And this is also where the Neighboring China idea initially took shape. In many places along the Nepal-Tibet border, there has been a sharp increase of cross-border trade and exchange over the past decade. Fervent road construction on the Tibetan plateau and railway construction in China led to a situation in which many of the valleys of northern Nepal are now much easier accessible from the north, from Tibet, than from the south. In many of the high valleys bordering Tibet, you now have Chinese roads that literally come to the border, while there are still no roads that go up from the lowlands of Nepal. As a result of this asymmetry in infrastructure, neighboring China has become a crucially important aspect in people's lives in these highland border areas. These yaks here just come back from the roadhead in Tibet, which is about a day's walk away. Although this image breathes a rather different atmosphere than the line of trucks we've seen in the starting slide, the world of trucks and the roads is actually an integral part of what we see here as well. These yaks wouldn't be there, and these goods wouldn't be there, were it not for the new roads that come down from the Tibetan border. But people living in proximity to the PRC's borders are looking towards China not only for trading opportunities, but also for investment and for alternative models of development. Some detest what they see, while others believe that the Chinese model is delivering on its promises in ways that Western development schemes never did. What we see on this image is the radical conversion of a slash-and-burn agriculture in Southeast Asia to a Chinese-invested agribusiness, namely in the special region number 4 of northern Myanmar. These are banana plantations, and you see the white tubes, that's the irrigation system for the banana plantations. So it is safe to say that those living around the borders of the People's Republic, neighboring China, for those living around the borders of the People's Republic, neighboring China has come to shape life in profound and lasting ways. And just from these very first few images, it becomes clear that neighboring does not look and feel and mean the same in different places. People, in the end, may wear the same clothes and shoes. They may buy the same TV sets and solar panels. They may enchant their children with exactly the same toys in Kyrgyzstan or Laos, while at the same time, there are obvious and vast differences in attitudes, opportunities, and fears. However, the similarities, I think, are deeper than just buying the same kinds of things made in China that probably all come from Yiwu in the end, yeah? What we find in many of the mountain areas along China's edge is a highly mobile and multilingual and in many cases a distinctly cosmopolitan population, quite in contrast to the still widespread imaginary of the remote and rugged periphery. You often find an outward-directed energy in these places, a veritable obsession with connections to the outside world. And now, a quarter of a century after the end of the Cold War, a part of this energy is again directed towards making relations across the border with China. Moreover, these seemingly remote borderlands at China's edge, they share a history. They experienced a moment of closure in the mid-20th century, followed by a process of opening up, as I will explain in a minute. The question I seek to address in this talk is how to make sense of this set of different yet related experiences of neighboring China. There is probably not such a thing as the one and all explaining big pattern to be found, but definitely there are patterns that can neither be explained on the basis of purely idiosyncratic local histories, nor by focusing exclusively on geopolitical situations, globalization flows, and so on. In this talk, I would like to suggest two ideas to make sense of the similarities and the variation I see. For the first, I will use the label cartographic anxiety. The second is the notion of pathways. I will argue that the constellation of cartographic anxiety and pathways is able to shed light on certain patterns that emerged along China's mountainous land borders. Now, the term cartographic anxiety is not mine, of course. It was first used in two unrelated publications, 1994, by Derek Gregory and Shankaran Krishna. And it has been employed since in a variety of contexts and to a variety of ends. And my own thinking about the term is actually directly linked to a panel Franck Pillet is organizing for a conference early next year, for which I'm currently writing a paper. I cannot claim any sort of ownership of this of the notion, although I'd like to do that, actually. It's a good one. But I find it very evocative and productive to think with. In a rather direct sense, the borderlands at China's edge are a product of cartographic anxieties. Red lines drawn on imperial maps during the Great Game and its aftermath, from the Durand Line to the McMahon Line, created realities on the ground that continue to haunt people and places from the Pamirs to the eastern slopes of the Himalayas. This is a copy of the existing Tibetan copy of the McMahon Line document from the Shimla Conference, 1914. These anxieties became even more accentuated in the process of nation-state building and the demarcation of borders, especially the borders of the People's Republic. China's borders, border conflicts with India, with the Soviet Union, and later with Vietnam, led to a phase of closure in which many of the former nodes of exchange along China's edge became peripheries in the most remote corners of the newly founded nation-states. From the Tian Shan and the Pamirs to the eastern Himalayas, remoteness is thus often a rather recent condition, a direct result of the political fallout of cartographic anxiety. However, since the early 1990s, and at an increasing pace since the 2000s, a process of opening up, closely linked to expectations of prosperity, started being superimposed onto these older concerns about protecting the geobodies of the nation-states, of the newly founded nation-states. And again, maps and map-making are crucial in this process. In my view, this is also a form of cartographic anxiety, but this time more in the sense of hope, of potential, of ambition. From Central Asia to Yunnan, there is high-level talk of new Silk Roads and economic corridors, and the remote peripheries at the edge of nation-states are conceived of as junctures once more, as junctures that hinge together Asia as a region. Very often, this form of cartographic anxiety is linked to natural resources, to their exploitation, and possible transport links to make use of this. Anxiety is a good term in this way, I think, because it embraces both fear and hope. Cartographic anxiety, as a particular form of anxiety, describes a preoccupation with maps and spaces, their strategic importance, and their potential as resource of one or another kind. Cartographic anxiety shapes imagination and geopolitical thinking. It undergirds policy, and it also undergirds moral reasoning. Cartographic anxiety is something real and palpable. It's a real and palpable force in the borderlands stake. Such anxieties define some of the basic conditions in which neighboring takes place. Yet, as important as these cartographic anxieties are, they often conjure up realities that are far away from those found on the ground. Maps and the fantasies attached to them, they usually don't account for the weather, for the snow, for the landslides, for all these things that happen in these mountainous regions. And despite being representations of territory, they usually lack any sense of terrain. They usually glimpse over the actual physical landscape that affords certain routes and forbids others. This is a satellite image of the central Himalayas, the Tibetan plateau to the north, the Ganges plains in the south, the hills of Nepal, and West Bengal and Bhutan in the middle. And this leads us to the second notion I would like to introduce, namely the notion of pathways. This area is structured not only by ecological zones. We see the dry and arid plateau in the north and the humid hills and plains in the south. Not only by ecological zones and the borders of nation states, but also what I call pathways, namely the easiest and safest passages across the high mountains. And these pathways, they continue to shape the lives and stories and the ambitions of people who live in the Himalayas. Now, to be clear, my project is certainly not about establishing some new form of eco or geodeterminism. And terrain does not define things like religion or particular cultural forms. On the contrary, we find a huge variety of religions and cultural forms in this area. And terrain does not shape politics in a direct way. But it does one thing for sure. It defines where people walk, where they move. And pathways, these lines I jotted here, they do not just denote flows of people and goods. They stand at the same time for a physical configuration rendered social by motion. Along these pathways, caravans traveled, and now roads are being built or planned. In some cases... Oh, not yet finished. But pathways are actually more than just trade routes. While trade is important, it represents only a fraction of what is exchanged along a pathway. I think of pathways as geographic and social figurations along which exchange is channeled. And I think pathways are good to think with for several reasons. First, they structure what is otherwise imagined as a uniform frontier space. Pathways highlight asymmetries and thereby facilitate a critical new reflection on the relations within a given border region. They create somehow their own hinterlands, so to say, because areas away from a pathway, they very often are not so much oriented towards a center, but they are oriented towards these pathways. And the dynamics between pathways and hinterlands are rather different from the dynamics between urban centers and peripheries. And second, the idea of pathways invites us to think about relations between them. The rise of one is very often the fall of another one, as they are embedded in larger regional systems of exchange. And third, as pathways are afforded by certain kinds of terrain, they are relatively stable, and usually they feature long histories of exchange. Their importance, the ways in which they are used, the goods and people that move along them, they may change, but the physical configuration more or less remains the same. Deeply social but embedded in terrain, they breathe a very different temporality than the cartographic anxieties outlined before. And this, of course, leads us back to the relations between pathways and cartographic anxieties. In some cases, the importance of a certain pathway was a direct result of cartographic anxieties. for example, the Kalimpong-Lhasa route gained tremendous importance with Francis Young Husband's infamous 1904 Young Husband expedition to Tibet, which forcefully re-established this route as a major trade link between Tibet and British India. The Young Husband expedition was a direct outcome of British cartographic anxiety, namely the fear of Russian influence in Tibet. Or this one, the Pamir Highway. It was built as a strategic road to guard the frontiers of the Soviet Union. In many places, it follows old trade routes, and in certain places, it creates new connections between old trade routes. A very similar thing could be said of the Ngari Highway between Xinjiang and Tibet, built in the 1950s as a supply route for the Red Army to facilitate its presence in western Tibet. It too followed established pathways linking Kashgar and Ladakh with western Tibet. The latter is also an example for the opposite relation, namely cartographic anxieties that can create directly, arise from existing pathways. The Ngari Road crosses Aksai Chin, which is claimed by India, and thus this road very directly triggered the Sino-Indian War in the early 1960s. Although it was completed around 1954-55, it took the Indians a few years to realize that somebody had actually built a road on their territory. But when they realized, it was the actual reason for war. And more recently, another set of cartographic anxieties focuses on pathways, namely the cartographic hopes to revive all kinds of old routes all around China, as usually called new silk roads, as corridors of trade and exchange envisioned to bring prosperity. The example here is the Chinese border gate at Hojiao on the Yunnan-Myanmar border. And the idea here is to revive the northern branch of the old Stillwell Road, constructed as an alternative supply route from British India to China during the times of the Japanese occupation of Burma in the 40s. So the point I seek to make is this. Pathways and cartographic anxieties are not two independent variables, so to say. They are closely entangled, of course. Yet, nevertheless, understood as two dimensions, they open an analytical field in which we can locate the various cases of neighboring across China's frontiers. This leads to this admittedly very crude model, namely a matrix of four social spatial settings. First, there is a setting where a pathway, with all the dynamics of exchange that it fosters, is combined with relatively little cartographic anxiety. And second, we have a situation where pathway dynamics meet with much cartographic anxiety. Third, we have a situation where we have no pathway, but more of a hinterland situation that is combined with little cartographic anxiety. And fourth, we have a hinterland where there is lots of cartographic anxiety. Let us first look at the pathway plus little cartographic anxiety situation. This is Hilsa, the border between Humla district in western Nepal and Tibet. From here, it's about 5 to 6 days walking to Simikot, the district capital of Humla. There is an airport in Simikot, but there is no road that would connect Humla district to the rest of Nepal. On the right, you can see a little fence, like a few containers, blue containers, and a little fence. This is the actual border. This little fence is the actual border between Nepal and China. It's an improvised little fence, and there is a gate, and that gate is usually open. On the top left corner, you see a road. That is the beginning of the Chinese road network. From here, you can basically travel all the way to Lhasa or Kashgar on a paved road now. This is really where it ends and where it stops. So it's about 200 meters from the roadhead on the Chinese side to the Nepal border. And then you have this little suspension bridge. And this is the lifeline that links the Chinese road system with the valleys of northern Nepal. This setting, a new Chinese roadhead on the border, but no road access from the south, this is a situation we see in several valleys of northern Nepal bordering Tibet. Whatever is consumed in Humla, from wheat flour to kitchen utensils, from shoes to solar panels and TV sets, from batteries to alcohol, from carpets to pillows, whatever is consumed in northern Humla is carried across this little bridge, and then it is transported on the backs of pack animal and people down the valleys. And despite this being the Tibetan border, there is relatively little geographic anxiety here. There is no geopolitical threat. The border is settled. There is no border conflict, really. There are no big new Silk Road plans in this region. There is no mining interest. There are no big kind of deposits of any precious minerals. There is a relatively liberal border regime that allows locals to cross over to the other side with just a border pass. You don't need to go and get a visa to cross to the other side. You just get a border pass, and with this you can cross back and forth as much as you want. On that border pass, you can even go and work in China for a few months a year. It's a relatively liberal regime. On the Nepal side, there is practically no government presence whatsoever. After the civil war in Nepal, all the government presence actually vanished. There is no customs office. There is nothing. There is really nothing. A few police, but they're only interested in checking trekking permits of the Indian pilgrims that use this route to go to Kailash. On the Chinese side, about 20 miles up, there is a blacktopped road. On that blacktopped road, there is a border post, but it acts very much like the other posts in China. It checks people and it checks goods moving in, but it doesn't really. There is not really any red tape on exports from China. So it's this semi-permeable membrane, in a sense, that lets goods out, but not really in. And this setting, a pathway with all its dynamics plus little cartographic anxiety, this is a situation that greatly benefits local traders. And there has been a veritable boom of making use of these opportunities, this setting affords. This young man, for example, he was a teacher in a local school when I met him first in 2011. He was very, very eager to kind of do something for his district, and his plan was to make his school as good as the schools in Kathmandu. And a year later, he gave up on that dream, and he became a roadside trader. He went up to the Tibetan side, and he asked for credit, and he got credit from one Uyghur from Xinjiang and one Kampa from eastern Tibet, and they kind of provided him with credit for his first stock of goods and a tent, and he established this tent together with about 50 other people on this close to the border, and he started selling goods, and he made about 6, 7, 8 times as much money as he would ever get in his teacher job in that first season. I was walking up and down this pathway a few times, and with me was a friend from this region, my research assistant, and we kept meeting his old friends from school and from his time in Kathmandu, and it was really amazing. I mean, almost everybody we met, they had the same story. They had jobs somewhere, and they kind of gave them up and moved back to this border situation in order to make use of this new opportunity. That pays much better than any NGO job in Kathmandu. An old friend of mine who started working there, he had a very good NGO job, actually. He made easily $3,000-$4,000 a month, kind of doing this sort of trade. This guy less, but that was also in a place where there were more tents. It is important to understand that this is an old pathway. Most of the parents' generation of these people were still engaged in some sort of cross-border business. And the phase of closure here was relatively brief. And there is thus a living memory which closely links prosperity to trade, not to agriculture, not so much to pastoralism, but to trade. With the new roads and the new railways to Xinjiang in Tibet, and with the PRC's Great Western Development Scheme that brings jobs and capital to Western Tibet, and with the currently relatively liberal border regime that facilitates trade and movement of people across the border, these old pathways once more began to channel ambitions and dreams. And in this context, the Himalayan entrepôt, the seasonal trade mart, which is such an old and important institution in all over the Himalayas, it has seen a stark revival of the last 3-4 years, actually, in several places, not just here. Rather different is the situation where you have all the dynamics of pathways, but combined with more cartographic anxiety. Back to this image we saw at the beginning. This is a visual expression of such a situation. Although the Chinese border post on the Torungat Pass between Xinjiang and Kyrgyzstan is also this sort of semi-permeable membrane, and the Kyrgyz one is still rather flexible, which means you can still actually bring pretty much everything across this border, despite the Russian-led customs union to which Kyrgyzstan ascended earlier this year. There is much, much more red tape on both sides involved here. On the one hand, the widespread fear of China's ambitions in Central Asia and the Russian attempts at re-establishing its former sphere of influence has led to an increase in cartographic anxiety. On the other hand, China is anxious about potential Uyghur separatists and terrorists crossing back and forth. So there is no border pass scheme here that would facilitate local trade. And on the Chinese side, the entire border area is actually off limits, and you can't even get close to the border without proper permission. Passengers crossing the pass require special permits and pre-organized guided means of transport on both sides of the border, and the customs clearance of goods, while it is still possible and still relatively flexible, official statistics of exports of goods from Xinjiang, they're about 90% higher than the official statistics of imports on the Kyrgyz side. So most of it still goes across the border without being properly tariffed, despite the customs union. It might change now, but that was at least what was the situation a few months ago. So despite this possibility that you can still bring goods, it's much more difficult for smaller shuttle traders or for kind of local trade to make use of these things. What you need is good connections with the high officials on both sides. And this very clearly it favors the larger logistics companies. Thus, the sort of situation we have here is a situation where you have these truck logistics companies that moved in, and they established ties unto the border authorities on both sides. Thus, neighboring here is much more mediated and professionalized as an experience than it is in Nepal. And brokering, this traditional role of being a broker that kind of facilitates movement of goods and people back and forth, is profitable only on a certain scale. Villages and smaller towns on both sides seem to profit little from this situation. The trucks never stop and just pass through from Kashgar to Bishkek. A very similar situation can be observed at Irkistan, the other crossing between Xinjiang and Kyrgyzstan, as well as at the Kolma Pass that leads from Xinjiang to Tajikistan. There is almost no local trade that makes use of these connections. It's almost exclusively these logistics companies that operate there. And while there is ample talk of new Silk Roads and economic corridors relating to these Central Asian pathways, this remains mainly another form of cartographic anxiety that has very little effect on the local neighboring situation day to day. The third situation is characterized by the absence of a pathway and cartographic anxiety. This is a situation where, on the one hand, you still find the last remains of Zomia in James Scott's sense, like the remote refuge where the high art of not being governed is still practiced to a certain extent. This is an image of a Lahu village in northern Laos. It shows an almost prototypical hilltop settlement. They practice slash-and-burn agriculture. There is no government office up here. There is no village head. There is no school. There is no military presence up here at all. And these houses, they you can basically build such a house in a few days. It takes about 4 days to build a house when everybody helps. So there is very little investment in this place, and they could still move on because there are still plenty of mountaintops that you could still choose to settle. But of course, neighboring, this is about maybe 35 kilometers from the border with China. But of course, neighboring China on the rise also left its traces here. And this is only one side of the situation hinterland with little anxiety. Because here, land is cheap and the border is close. So you see all the Chinese agribusinesses moving into this sort of setting, with banana plantations, rubber plantations, producing vegetables, producing whatnot, on land leased, usually leased for 10, 20, 30, 50 years, just across the border in this part of Southeast Asia that these images were shot. So this is a situation you see in parts of Burma, and you see it in Laos especially. Laos is amazing how this entire landscape has been transformed over the last 10, 15 years. I was in Laos in 1997, and this was all basically jungle and practically impossible to, very difficult to travel. And now it's all new Chinese roads. And it's all Chinese agro-industry. I mean, huge plantations of mainly banana and rubber. You wouldn't see it at first sight, but these forests of these hills, they're all rubber plantations. This is the special region 4 in Myanmar, a place called Mongla, on the border to China, right on the border to China, controlled by the Hua army still, but this is the archetypal casino town that started off as a vice economy where all the Chinese gamblers would come over and gamble. But then again, you have all these this sort of transformation. I mean, now you have all the agro industry that actually shapes this place at least as much as the casinos. The casinos disappeared for a while because of problems with the Chinese state, but they came back. They are heavily coming back. And now a little further away from the border, about maybe a 10-minute drive, there is a new casino town being constructed. So what we have here is a situation where you have Chinese capital and Chinese companies combined with very little red tape but an ample rhetoric of spearheading development. Yeah, that's what the Chinese companies say, which is we're bringing development to this region. And many people locally would agree, especially here in this special region number 4. So in several of these regions where you have this sort of setting, you have casinos. And you have all the economy surrounding them. And of course, you have prostitution, you have gambling, you have all these dilapidated zoos where you can kind of look at an old crocodile, and you have all the wildlife trade. I mean, you can find pangolin scales and tiger paws on the market in Mongla, literally there. But then again, you have this other thing. You have these jobs that these casinos produce. And these young ladies here, they are all working in one of the casinos in Mongla. And it's very well-paying jobs. They earn about three times as much as you would get in other places deeper inside Burma. And it's not one single Burmese-speaking girl among them, or boy. It's both, actually. It's just an accident that there is no man on this image. Because they speak languages. So this old thing of kind of being growing up in a very multilingual sphere, the most of them speak fluent Chinese, and then they speak Shan, because it's Shan state, and then they speak, and Shan is very close to Thai, and then they speak one or two local languages. They all speak four or five languages. Yeah? And this facilitates, or this enables them to work in these casinos as in a way that neither Chinese nor people from Burma would have, and it's all very close together. I mean, from that Lahu hilltop village to one of the big casino towns, it's about an hour's drive. Yeah, it's all very close together. And finally, there is a fourth situation, namely a hinterland combined with much geographic anxiety. Now, I'm not sure if you can really talk of active neighboring in such a situation, because usually there is not much contact. One example of this is Ladakh. Of course, this is a region that was formerly very much characterized by the dynamics of pathways and long-distance trade, actually very much at the center of much of this trade between Central and South Asia. But cartographic anxiety, conflicts between China and Pakistan, and the conflicts between India and China, they brought all these bustling crossroads to a standstill. And this image is taken at one of the border villages that in the Kargil district, just about half a kilometer from the line of control between Pakistan and India. And the interesting thing is that it's now becoming some sort of a destination for domestic tourists, for border tourism. Yeah? So from this kind of remotest place at the very edge of the nation state, from this kind of node in along important pathways, it became this kind of remotest place at the very edge of the nation state. And as such, it is again interesting in all these, in the context of this rhetoric of nation building. So, I mean, the Kargil War in India is a very important, the 1999 Kargil War in India is a very important thing. And people come here to see what happened, because this was one of the areas where the Kargil War actually happened. Mm. So there is not much of day-to-day neighboring in such a context, in such situations. And if there is contact, it is probably mediated through the armed forces. The military presence in such areas are high, and the military presence brings in all these things. On this image we see all the oil barrels that in front of a Mani wall with these stones written, Omani Pemihun. And this is an image you see in many places in Ladakh, yeah? And it's sort of a material evidence of this type of situation. All the oil is carried in, but it's a one-way street, and nobody's taking back the barrels. And so the barrels they remain there, and they've become a very important resource in Ladakh. Many of the prayer wheels you see in Ladakh are actually made out of these oil barrels, or of the metal used from these oil barrels. Or there is this entire a craft of traditional Ladakhi stoves, metal stoves, that only started in the 70s when the Indian Army, or in the 60s when the Indian Army started bringing up this ample resource of scrap metal. Yeah, then they started working on this. So what I want to say with this is the connections in such a situation, that because they are cut, because there is too much anxiety and there is no more such a thing as a pathway dynamic, all this energy obsessed with the outside world is of course directed to in other directions. And here it is very much directed towards India. What you can do is tourism. This picture is taken on Pangongso. This is a lake that actually forms the border with a China, and it's one of these places where you still have lots and lots of military bases on both sides. But yet, it has also become this sort of mecca for domestic Indian tourists over the past 4 or 5 years. It started out with a film, Amir Khan's Three Idiots, about 5 or 6 years ago. And this was such an important, such a famous film that this spot, this Pangongso, has become a major, major tourist attraction. It's basically one of the must-sees if you go to Ladakh, if you do Ladakh, as many of the young Indians do. Preferably with an Enfield, and preferably kind of restaging this sort of setting not at the crossroads of trade, but at the very end of the nation state, where you kind of use all your energy and strength to reach the end of it. So while in this last setting neighboring is hardly a day-to-day experience, except perhaps for the military, you could make that argument, maybe not in Ladakh, but certainly in Arunachal Pradesh, there's probably quite a lot of stuff going through the military across the border, but don't quote me on that. So while there is hardly any day-to-day practice of neighboring, the first three settings, they follow their very own styles and logic of neighboring that is tightly linked to both the presence or absence of a pathway and the dynamics it involves, and of cartographic anxiety. And while the model introduced here is certainly a very oversimplified thing, it's a very crude model, I believe that it does explain some sort of variation without resorting to exclusively local nor exclusively global or geopolitical explanations. So what I'm looking for with this is to find a middle ground to explain things not just out of themselves, out of their little small histories, and not just out of kind of the big topics of China in the world, but of an interplay of these things. And I'm very eager to hear your comments on all of this, because this is literally just 5 days old. So thank you very much for your attention.